Welcome to this to the committee meeting on rural development and reform. The purpose of the meeting basically is to deal with two issues. The first issue is the briefing by the Department of Rural Development and Land Reform on the restitution of land rights amendment bill. And the second one, of course, would be the briefing by the Auditor General, which will come immediately after this briefing. As a result, we are not going to deal with the minutes of the previous meeting. We can deal with those minutes tomorrow, at our meeting tomorrow. So those are the only two items for the meeting of today. I'm also informed that in terms of technology, we are not able to show the presentation on the screen behind me, which therefore means that members will have to focus on the hard copy presentation that they were given. I'm informed that the presentation will be in line with the hard copy that we are having. So please concentrate on the hard copy, because technology is partially failing us. While sitting here, I have the privilege because the screen can show in front of me, but it doesn't show behind me, so you bear with us. I'm told that the arrangement is that they will make sure that the privilege that I'm having is withdrawn with immediate effect. It will be passed over to you, then as you proceed, you'll be able to watch the presentation on the screen. So without much ado, colleagues, I'm going to give to the department to lead us on this presentation.
Good morning, Honourable Chair and Honourable Members. Thank you for the opportunity. And just wanted to introduce the team that I'm with. I've got on the far end, Pepo Mashael, who is CD Legal in the department. And I've got Tamim Kelose Udozo, who's the Deputy Chief Land Claims Commissioner, and I've got Tapelo, Tswe Neng, who is acting CFO. And Tammy Ndondwa is going to be the one who's going to be doing the presentation today. Thank you. And Honourable Chair, just to inform you that the DG has apologized. Unfortunately, he could not be able to attend.
Okay, the floor is yours, sir.
Thank you, Honorable Chair and Honorable Members. Good morning. In this presentation, we are going to request the honourable members to consider a hard copy of the presentation, which will be presented together with the bill as introduced in Parliament. On slide number two, we set out the presentation outline. The presentation is on the restitution of land rights Amendment Bill of 2013. It is Bill number 35 of 2013. In terms of the presentation outline, we are going to take the House through an overview of the restitution program, the review or evaluation of the program that was conducted by the department, the regulatory impact assessment that was conducted on behalf of the department, the policy reforms that are coming out of this evaluation and impact assessment, the provisions of the restitution of land rights amendment bills itself, implications of what is proposed in the bill to the organization, implications for communication purposes, and I will briefly take the House through consultations that have already been undertaken as part of the process. On slide number three, the slide is titled Overview of the Restitution Process. The mandate for restitution comes from Section 257 of the Constitution, which provides that a person or a community is possessed of property as a result of past racial discriminatory law practices, which dispossession took place after 1919, is entitled to restitution to an extent that may be provided for in an act of parliament. Restitution then is one of the four elements of government land reform program. Other elements are land restitution, land tenure reform, and development. The Restitution of Land Rights Act, is Act number 22 of 1994, as it currently stands, regulates the restitution process. It provides for the establishment of the Commission on Restitution of Land Rights, which is a commission that is mandated to solicit land claims, to investigate land claims, and to attempt to resolve them through mediation and negotiation. The Restitution Act also establishes the Land Claims Court, which is a court that adjudicates disputes that arise out of the restitution process. The qualification criteria for restitution is also set out in the Restitution Act, providing that a person, a community, a descendant of the other person, and an estate can lodge a claim if it was dispossessed after 19 June 1913 of rights in land as a result of past racial discriminatory laws and practices. Slide number four, titled Review, Social Evaluation of the Program. The Honourable Members will be aware that the Department published the Green Paper on Land Reform in 2011. Insofar as the restitution program is concerned, that Green Paper stated as one of the challenges facing land reform, the restrictive restitution model. That conclusion was arrived at as a result of an evaluation of the program that was carried out by the department by the stakeholders, beneficiaries of land reform restitution in particular themselves, and through interaction with beneficiaries through provincial workshops that were held in each province between December 2010 and April 2011. And a national workshop that was attended by 1,296 beneficiaries who were asked to evaluate the impact of the restitution program. They were asked to identify shortcomings, successes, and advise government on what needed to be done. One of the outcomes of that evaluation was that the restitution program is indeed restrictive because deserving persons and communities are not participating on the program. Those who do not participate in the program are those that do not lodge their claim by 31 December 1998. One of the requirements for restitution, in addition to showing that land was dispossessed after 19 to 1913 as a result of past racial discriminatory laws and practices, is that a person must lodge a claim for restitution no later than the 31st of December. So the evaluation then revealed that that was the first category of people who were deserving but cannot participate in the program because they did not lodge claims primarily. The second group that could not participate are persons and communities that were dispossessed of rights in land before 19 June 1913. The Honourable Members will recall that the date of 19 June 1913 is the date when the Native Land Act of 1913 was enacted. And the third group of people that could not participate communities that were dispossessed as a result of the implementation of government planning policies, particularly in the Eastern Cape. There is evidence that before 31 December 1998, when government and stakeholders and partners were informing communities and people who lodged their claims, that in the Eastern Cape, because of an error in the interpretation of law and policy, communities dispossessed because of settlement planning policy were advised not to lodge their claims. The White Paper on Land Reform, South African Land Policy in 1997, has stated that such people would be provided redress through alternative forms of land reform, basically land redistribution and land tenure reform. It then turned out later that such an interpretation and those provisions of the White Paper were in fact incorrect and unlawful. These communities, approximately 800 of them, have since taken government to court, claiming damages as a result of the action of government in advising them not to lodge land claims. So they then are in their capable of preserving the persons that were excluded from the restitution program. Slide number 5, titled Review of Slow Evaluation of the Program, which is a continuing topic. We then set out briefly the reasons that were given by those who did not lodge claims. They have informed government that the research methodology that informed the design of the restitution program itself was poor, that people who were dispossessed of their land over a period of 3.5 centuries, they have been given a total of 3 years to lodge claims for such dispossession, was in itself improper. That the window period that was provided to lodge claims was too short, that the communication campaign informing people about restitution and that there is a requirement that claims must be lodged did not reach every corner of the country, that the verification systems of the commission are poor, resulting in the exclusion of deserving people from the program, and lastly, that the communities in the Eastern Cape in particular, dispossessed of settlement planning, were excluded from the restitution program. The department then appointed consultants to do a regulatory impact assessment, and slide number 6 set out briefly the findings of the regulation impact assessment. It identifies two options which are available. Option number 1 is to retain the 1998 cut-off date for restitution and try and find solutions for those excluded elsewhere. Option number 2 is an option to reopen the restricted time frame in the Restitution Act to allow for submission of new claims by various categories of persons and communities excluded from the current restitution program. Regulatory impact assessment recommends the second option, that of the reopening of lodgement of claims. The consultants were then also asked to estimate the number of claims that are likely to be lost, and this was a difficult exercise both for the department and for the consultants that conducted the regulatory impact assessment, but they arrived at a figure of 397,000 claims that in their view are going to be valid claims. The number of 397,000 is not the number in their view of the claims that are going to be lodged, but valid claims that are likely to be lodged. The number of lodgements may actually be higher than the number of 397,000. In the regulatory impact assessment document, they then set out how they arrive at this figure of 397,000. They then studied progress that has been made in the restitution program thus far, and the cost to government, and they then have arrived at an estimation that, depending on the option that the claimants will choose, the cost for the reopening of lodgement of claims for the settlement of new claims will be between 129 and 179 billion depending on the options that the successful claimants will choose, and provided that those claims are settled within a period of 15 years. In arriving at this figure, again, they consider issues such as inflation, and they could only come up with figures that are acceptable if they were benchmarking those against what has been achieved in the implementation of the restitution program over the last 15 years. Slide number 7 then summarizes what government proposes be done as a result of these findings. The slide is titled Policy Reform, and we quote from the State of the Nation address that was delivered by the President on the 14th of February in 2013, where he announced that there are proposed amendments to the Restitution of Land Rights Act in order to provide for the reopening of lodgement of claims by people who meet the deadline of 31 December 1998. Then also to be explored are exceptions to the June 1913 cut-off date to accommodate claims by the descendants of the Khoi and the Sen, as well as heritage sites and historical landmarks. This Restitution of Land Rights Amendment Bill that we are presenting today is then it talks directly to the first part of the quotation relating to the amendment of the Restitution Act provide for the reopening. We are busy developing a policy on the exceptions to the 1913 native and cut-off date, and in due course then there will be a departmental policy that is proposed. Work on 1913 and dispossessions before that is then currently being done by the department. Slide number 8 then sets out the provisions of the bill. But perhaps before we get to slide number 8, the work relating to the Restitution of Land Rights Amendment Bill that is being presented is work that was that has been going on since 2006. There have been many groups, communities and individuals that have approached government, and they have approached Parliament as well, requesting an extension to restitution. So the speed with which this amendment, the department was able to carry out the amendment, was because of the availability of sources of information, as a lot of work had been done by those who were proposing and who have been proposing since 2003, at least that there must be the reopening of lodgement of claims. Whereas the amendments relating to 1913 are very, very complex, and they require government to undergo a more detailed consultation process, a more detailed research and investigation process before it can consider any policy option. So then going to slide number 8, the provisions of the bill itself. The bill largely stands and falls by its clause 1. Clause 1 proposes the amendment of section 21E of the Restitution Act to extend the date for lodgement of claims to 31 December 2018. Presently, section 2 subsection 1 sets out the criteria that a person must satisfy in order for them to be provided restitution. And subsection E of 2.1 then states that for you to qualify, you must have lodged a claim no later than the 31st of December 1998. And 2.1E is then, it is proposed to be amended by clause 1 to reopen restitution for a period of 5 years. Initially, the proposal was that there should not be a cut-off date for the lodgement of claims, and that was coming directly from beneficiaries of restitution, people who had lodged claims, and then also from people who had not lodged claims arguing that since the dispossessions were carried out over 3.5 centuries, people should be given, others were even saying at least 100 years for them to lodge their claim. The period was, after intense discussion, reduced to 5 years, to 10 years, and when the matter was discussed at cabinet, it was then further reduced to a period of 5 years. During these 5 years, there are going to be, people are going to be lodging claims, and the requirements for lodging a claim have been set out in various court decisions. For an example, if the description of the property that you are claiming is incorrect, then your claim is limited to that particular description of the property. So it would be required of the Commission, before the closing date of the lodgement of claims, that claimants must be assisted as much as possible in lodgement of their claims. We have currently claims have been lodged where the description of the property says we are claiming the land between X River and Y Mountain. The property descriptions are not provided for. For government, for the Commission to be able to establish the extent of the claim, you have to physically visit the property and take GPS coordinates, superimpose that on a map, and then you will get the property description. So for the claims that may not be researched, it is not possible then to say there is a claim on this property or there is no claim on this property with absolute certainty. So with the proposed reopening, those are the small but significant things that we as the Commission would like to be done. And obviously for that to place, sufficient time must be given not only to the claimant, but also to the Commission that is required to assist the claimant in the lodgement of their claims. And those are some of the things that informed the deadline that is being proposed on 31 December 2018. This deadline is on the basis that this bill will be passed by the end of December 2018. If the timelines are extended beyond that, then the date at a later date it will be proposed to be amended. The principle is that the reopening must be for a period of 5 years. Clause number 2 of the bill proposes the amendment of Section 11(1) of the Act. Section 11(1) sets out the procedure to be followed after the lodgement of the claim. The Commission is required to investigate, and after investigating, the Commission is required to determine whether it is due, the claim meets the requirements for restitution or not. For those claims that meet the requirement for restitution, Section 11(1) requires the Commission to publish the details relating to the claim in the Government Gazette and in the district where the land is located. What has been found during implementation is that the providing notice only in the district is not sufficient, because people, when during dispossession, sometimes are removed from areas further than just the district where the land is located. A typical example, people removed in urban land in Port Elizabeth, you find most of them in Cape Town. So if you are dealing with a claim in Port Elizabeth in the Eastern Cape, and you only make known in the district that there is a claim, interested and affected parties out of that district do not then get to know that there is a claim. And the purpose behind that notification is so that you can identify other people that may have an interest in the claim, that may provide other information with regards to the property that has been claimed. So the proposed amendment in clause 2 is that when the Commission then has accepted the claim, it must make it known nationally through media, and what that media will be determined in relation that will come once if the bill is enacted. Clause number 3 is a consequential amendment. There are many sections in the Restitution Act that refer to the cut-off date for the lodgement of claims, which is presently 31 December 1998, and whenever that date appears, there is a proposed amendment that it must be extended to 31 December 2018. clause number four of the bill addresses two issues. The first is that it criminalizes any act or omission by a person which has the effect of preventing another person from lodging a claim. There have been instances where the Commission and the Department have been informed of people who have gone out of their way to try and get other people not lodge their claims. And the proposal is that that conduct must be criminalized. The second proposal that is contained in clause number four is that of the criminalization of the lodgement of a claim by a person who has an intention to defraud the state. From as early as the State of the Nation address in February this year, there have been people who have been saying, land claims are going to be opened, I'm going to go and research a coal mine, I'm going to place myself in the history of that coal mine, and I'm going to lodge a claim. And such conduct, a person like that will be submitting a claim only with an intention to default. And you are saying that as a control measure, we are proposing the criminalization of the lodgement of a claim by a person whose intention is to defraud the state. The investigation of the claim costs money, it takes a lot of time, and we do not want the resources of the state to be wasted by investigating fraudulent claims. Claims can be lodged and they can be dismissed. Those claims that are dismissed because they simply do not meet the requirements and there is no evidence that there was the claim was lodged just with the intention of defrauding the state, then nothing will happen there. But if there is information or evidence, then the matter will be handed over to the criminal justice system for further investigation. And it is proposed that the punishment that is meted to people found guilty of fraud be applicable in this case as well. Slide number nine, the provisions of the bill continue, contains clause number five. As we said earlier, two institutions implement restitution, the commission which investigates and tries to finalize, to settle claims through negotiation and mediation, and the second one, the Land Claims Court. The Land Claims Court is established by the Restitution of Land Rights Act. Initially, its mandate was to then deal with land claims. It has since, its mandate has since been extended to cover matters of labor tenancy, and they are the only court that has jurisdiction in when the issue is whether a person who resides in a farm is a labor tenant or not. And in relation to farm dwellers, occupier, people who reside on farm, they have automatic jurisdiction to review decisions of magistrate's court that says a person must be evicted. So if an application, if an owner of a farm brings an application in a magistrate court to evict a person from a farm, before that eviction can be executed, the matter must be referred to the Land Claims Court, which will then check and to see whether all the processes were correct, whether the decision to evict is correct. So its jurisdiction, since the enactment of the Restitution Act, has been expanded to other pieces of legislation. And the court was a court that was designed to be a temporary court. It was going to deal with restitution, and the honorable members will recall that initially restitution was supposed to be a five-year project, and court's life was linked to that time frame. And the processes for the appointment of judges, their conditions of service, were different compared to other high court judges. So clause number five then proposes, firstly, that the Land Claims Court must be properly capacitated and with judges. The process for the appointment of judges is being aligned with that of other high court judges, with the requirement that judges of the Land Claims Court must first meet the requirements and be appointed as judges of the high court. So in other words, if a person is desirous of being a judge of the Land Claims Court, they would first have to apply to be a judge of the High Court and through the Judicial Services Commission, which will make a recommendation to the President. And only after they have been appointed a judge of the High Court can they then be appointed as judges of the Land Claims Court. That will assist in improving the jurisprudence of court, the quality of judgments that come from that court with the training that High Court judges normally get. Currently, the process of appointing a judge for the Land Claims Court is such that it encourages people who are not necessarily lawyers to consider being judges. And then the Act requires that when the court is going to be looking at factual issues, that the court must be assisted by an assessor. Every time there is particular facts that are in dispute, then the court, the sitting judge is required to have an assessor appointed. Now, this proposal said that there must still continue to be an assessor, and that assessor may be a land expert, may be a person with all the necessary skills and experience and even education to understand land issues. And then such a person would then be paired with a jurist, a person that has met the requirements of the judge of the High Court. Then together they should be able to deal with matters that come before the Land Claims Court. The judges in the Land Claims Court, it is proposed, must be appointed for a period fixed by the President, and such appointment will then continue for the duration, provided that the person remains a judge of the High Court. When we engage the Office of the Chief Justice, the Department of Justice and Constitutional Development, the Land Claims Court itself, we became aware of a particular challenge that the judges in the Land Claims Court face, that at sometimes during the year, they have so many cases in the Land Claims Court, but most of them are not active. They don't require a judge to do work that judges are supposed to do on a daily basis. So they then require that they must be able on such days to make themselves available to the High Court so that they can also get exposed to other types of cases. These amendments in Clause 5 will allow that to happen. And then lastly, a judge, an acting judge of the High Court presently is appointed by the Minister of Justice. But in the Land Claims Court, an acting judge is appointed by the President because of the nature of the court, particularly if you look at the period when the Act was enacted in 1994. So another proposal, again contained in Clause 5, is that acting judges be appointed by the Minister of Justice to align that with the normal processes of the High Court. Clauses 6, 7, 8, and 9 then repeal sections in the Restitution Act that we're providing in one way or another for what is now contained in clause number 5 of the bill. Clauses 10, 11, and 12 are consequential amendments, again, in the sections that have been amended. There's a reference to lodging a claim by 31 December 1998, and that has been amended to 31 December 2018. The second last clause in the bill is clause number 12, and the first part in clause number 12 is a consequential amendment changing the date. The second part is a clause relating to the amendment of section 42, capital letter D. Section 42D empowers the minister to settle claims administratively, and there are factors that the court take into account when it is required to restore land. We are, with this amendment, it is proposed that the minister must consider those factors as well when settling claims administratively. Currently, there is no such requirement. There is nothing guiding the minister when he or she must take a decision on whether a claim should be settled administratively or not. Clause 13, the third part, section 3, provides for the extension of the minister's powers of delegation. The minister is empowered by the Restitution Act to enter into an agreement for the settlement of the claim, and that power is contained in section 42D. Section 42D of section 3 empowers the minister to delegate that power. Section 42BC empowers the minister to give development and other assistance to beneficiaries that have been awarded land. And section 42C provides for minister's power to delegate. Section 42E empowers the minister to acquire land, but in section 42E there is no provision for delegation. That then, on its own, effectively stops the minister's power. You can give, you can delegate the power to settle a claim, and that's signing a settlement agreement. Giving a development assistance, but the acquisition of land is a power that, in terms of the Restitution Act, there is no power found in the Restitution Act for the minister to delegate the acquisition of land. Currently, to delegate that power, you have to read the Act together with the Land Administration Act. It's Act No. 5 of 1995, which empowers the minister to delegate any power or authority in any piece of legislation under the administration of the minister.
Sorry, sir. You have to wrap up your presentation now.
Okay.
So that we can have some discussion.
Yeah. So, 12.3 then proposes that now. And then clause number 13 contains the short section, the short title of the bill. Slide number 11, organizational implications. Are going to be implications to the organization, the department and the commission. It is proposed that all the department's offices be used for the lodgement of claims, that 304 additional staff members will have to be brought in to assist in the lodging process. The department and commission will be assisted by youth participating in the NARISEC program in this, and that there will be at least 5 mobile units that will be acquired in order for the department to reach the most remote of areas. And it is estimated that the cost for this over lodgement period will be 549 million. Slide number 12 on communication implications. One of the reasons that was given by those who said that they did not claim was that the communication campaign did not reach a corner of the country. So the department is developing with government communication and information system a communication strategy that will be implemented after. If the bill is enacted. And then on slide number 13, just on the consultations that have taken place, there is a national reference group that is made up of stakeholders that participated in the development of the bill. During the consultation process, 75 consultative workshops were held with stakeholders throughout the country. 70 individuals and organizations submitted written comments, all of which were taken into account in arriving at the bill in the form that it is present. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you very much for your presentation. A very comprehensive presentation. I must also indicate that before I open for discussion, that during the occasion of the State of the Nation address that you referred to, it led to the establishment of an ad hoc committee on the 20th of June, 6th of June, sorry, the 6th of June. It is that ad hoc committee which also went out to do some oversight in terms of the terms of reference given to it, to look at the obstacles and blockages and new challenges that we may encounter as we move towards the second phase of the lodgement. And that part of committee consisted of this department, which is the lead department, the Department of Public Works, Arts and Culture, Human Settlement, COPTA, and Agriculture, Forest and Fisheries. And indeed, from the 1st to the 7th of September, an oversight was conducted in three provinces which were selected, Limpopo, Northwest, as well as KZN. And for George will be discussions, members, and I know it's not a meeting of actual committee, but members of this committee were part of the oversight to be able to share with the department their experiences arising out of those processes in terms of the exercise that we're engaging in today. And also, I think I understand your desire that by December this year, the bill must be passed. But looking at the processes that we have to undergo, it's a matter that I think we have to interrogate moving forward. Because you would know that this bill has already been tabled today, and we have been anxiously waiting. We're happy that it's finally here before us. But sure, there are certain processes that we have to undergo. We share the same desire, but that will be dependent upon the processes that we have to undergo that will lead us to the process of Parliament finally, you know, giving space for the bill to be adopted. But I think members will speak that as they contribute. I think I'll better make my comments later, not now. I just wanted to put on record those kind of issues that might be an impediment to the desire that we all have in terms of the process leading up to its finality. Well, members, here we are. That is the presentation from the department. I'll now invite you to make your comment. This time I'll start from my left, Honorable Kawa, November, Dapani, Abila, Swati, Melam, Mandela, and Matanyani. In that order.
Thank you, Chairperson. First, the Chair, I must thank the presentation. It is very informative, Chair. But Chairperson, I have only two questions in this presentation, Chairperson. Also, I'm willing to be corrected, Chair, if I am wrong. First, Chair, I'll start with the old claims, Chair, because I didn't see anything mentioning the old claims, what happened to the old claims, before we continue with the reopening, because I thought we're supposed to get the statistics of how many claims now are finished and how many are hanging. And also, Chair, number two, Chair, of question, that was the first one. The number two question is in the finance, Chair, the financial, Chair. Recommend option two. The reopening of lodgement of claims, estimated to 397. Valid claims will be lodged, and that it will cost between 129 to 179 billion. Also, Chair, it confuses me because in the memorandum, Chair, financial implication for state, it is not possible to determine what the financial implication will be. So, Chairperson, my question is that where the department get this estimated financial in this document, and in other this document, they said it is not possible to I don't know, to determine what is the financial implication would be. Which department now, I must rely on it, because there are two, and they are not talking with the sending, even two, but they are coming in the one department. Thank you, Chairman.
Thank you, Chairman. My question will be based on the page 11 on organizational implication. We know that we've worked a long way up thus far, but as I see that establishment of 52 lodgements of to be located across South Africa, so we would like to know where the pieces are, so that we could help where we can help, where we are, where we stay. Secondly, also the additional employment of 34 staff members. That also, because it's of no use to deploy somebody who is in Pretoria, to deploy him deep in Engamak. That won't make sense, because at least that person won't know the environment good. So that also we need really to have people from that province, or people who really who understand the whole thing. Because mistakes just come in because we bring people from other side. I know that really it is difficult to get the right people in some provinces, but it would help to use people of that province or that region to help bring. And the youth also to be divided, so in the different provinces. And I think Ma'am Honorable Baba spoke to the budget issue. We just hope that we'll be having enough money to do this work. But also after all this processes of Parliament and so, one would be very much interested to know the exact date, because that is what the people want to know. When will this happen? They're just waiting for that. And thank you, Chair.
Honourable Tapan.
Thank you, Honourable Chair. Honourable Chair, my other questions have been covered, especially about the location of the 52 lodgements, less placement offices. What I want to find out from the department, amongst the reasons for not finalizing the previous claims, besides financial indications, it is the capacity. So what I want to find out now, what have you done to address the capacity problem within the department? Because to open, just to open, to reopen the lodgement of claims without addressing your weaknesses in the department, I don't think it's a very good idea. Another question is, how many claims were lost or were anticipated to be lost in the previous period, and what of the budget for that? I'm putting the question to you because of your estimation of the present reopening. Can you also clarify to me, actually I'm confining myself only on the previous slides, the solar document that you have given us. I'll just read this sentence about clarification. If it is not clear whether the processing of new claims would be done concurrently with the old claims, and which ones would take precedence if the claims overlap. I just want clarification on that one. I don't understand it. And the last question on that subject is these five mobile units, are you going to move them around the country, these five mobile units? Are they going to be moved around, or are they going to be in specific provinces? And lastly, all right, in slide number 12, where you say that all of the parties will be informed of a certain date for the lodging of a claim. What I want to know, how are you going to inform the people about this? Thank you, Honourable Chairperson.
Honourable Bunyamata.
Thank you, Chairperson. I appreciate the presentation, but there were only a few seeking questions to pose to the department. When reading at the memo of the object of the Restitution and Rights Amendment Bill 2.4, it indicates that exceptions to the 1918 Native Land Act cut off date will be dealt with separately. Can I just get an indication? How is the department going to deal with this separately? Is it not part of, was it not supposed to be dealt with when you amend the bill? Secondly, the issue of what would be the role of the municipalities in this whole process of reopening of the lodgement? You indicated that 549 million would be needed for administration purposes. What I want to find out is that 549 million included in the 129, the estimation of 129 billion to 179 billion that you will need for the period of 5 years? While you were presenting, you indicated that it was your wish for the Parliament to enact this act in December. But what I wanted to check is that according to your plan, when were you planning to start implementing this act? Then according to your plan, you have said to us you are expecting 387,000 claims, but according to your plan, each year, because this is the plan for the period, you're talking about the period of 5 years up to 2018, but how many claims are you planning to finalize each year? Because now we've got backlogs of pending claims. Now again, we're talking of the opening of the new lodgement of claims. How are you going to deal with the backlogs before the new process starts? Did you ever consider the issue of the financial compensation vis-a-vis the land restoration or land restitution to beneficiaries? We are talking of the alternative relief that is being used when looking at the Act Amendment. It talks of the alternative relief if beneficiaries are not accommodated in the land restitution. What I wanted to check is that did you ever experience those beneficiaries that were not qualifying to be part of the restitution? Did you provide them with an alternative relief? If yes, what are the successes and challenges of that alternative relief that you're providing to those beneficiaries? The gazetting of the claims, because they're talking of the province and the national on the amendment. What about the district? Because they've indicated that one of the challenges was that communication was not properly made. When unable to reach each and every corner of the country, then can you just clarify that too? Thank you, Chief.
Thank you, Honorable Fati.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. I've got some questions seeking clarity. My first one is with regard to slide number 5, the evaluation of the program, where it was actually some reasons were given that why people did not lodge claims. It talks of methodology that informed the design of the restitution program was poor. I just want to find out, is there any mechanism that is put in place so that there is not going to be a repetition of what happened in the first judgment? And the second one is people they said that the period was too short, and now it is given 5 years with this new lodgement. And I've heard that there were some people who were saying that they should just log it for maybe it would be okay for 100 years and above. So I actually want to know as to whether is the department actually sure on these 5 years. Are they going to cover everything in the 5 years so that we don't have that kind of a problem where people come back and say that we have this kind of problem? And the issue of verification, it also mentioned here that the system of verification, in fact, was very poor. I just want to know, because if this has been raised by those who didn't lodge claims, are we sure that with the new lodgement, this system will be corrected so that we don't have that kind of a problem? And how ready are you in that regard? And another issue is with on slide number 6 is with regard to the estimate of 370,000 that could be a valid change, or it can even be more. That it could even be more. And I just want to know, because now when we look back, those who have claimed the budget, the current budget that we've got, couldn't even cover cater all their claims in terms of money or in terms of getting back their land. The budget was not actually sufficient. Now we're talking of 129 to 179 billion. How are we going to get this kind of money? Is there any agreement between the department and the treasury to get the kind of amount to cover all this budget yet? And also, with regard to all these claims, 397,000 claims could also affect the already lodged claims. That you have indicated that some of the claims that were lodged were still are still being investigated. So now we are coming with the 397 as estimated. Is this not going to actually cause a confusion with regard to the previously lodged claims? Or how are you going to deal with these ones if this, we find some of the claims that have been lodged on this 397 having impact on those already you are still investigating, those those previous ones? And the issue it said that the claimants of those could be settled in 15 years. So I just want to find out, because 15 years, when we check in terms of the budget that we've got, can we actually raise, or can we be able, in terms of this 15 years, can the budget actually move up to the budget that we actually have every year? In 15 years, can it reach the 175 billion? So I just want to know, because if we're talking of 15 years, we're putting a target, but are we sure that the money that is put here, are we going to have it to cover all these things that we are actually anticipating? And the issue of the before 1913 cut-off date, It is said that it will be dealt in a separate way. Is it not going to affect this bill? Because for us, this bill to be actually amended, it was to cater the problems that were encountered by the people on the ground. So if we're saying we're going to put it aside, are we saying that this is only a matter of a policy? It's not going to affect the bill. I think that for now is all. Thank you very much.
Madam?
Thank you, Chairperson. My colleagues have already touched on the ability of the department to finance these restitution claims. And 179 billion. We've only spent 25 billion over the last 15 years, so I'm not going to emphasize that. I do want to emphasize, however, the organizational capacity of the department in particular the fact that in the last 15 years we had 80,000 claims more or less, of which we've settled 60,000 more or less. Now we're talking about a potential 400,000, 397,000. And my colleague Honorable Swate touched on the ability of the department to actually do its job and resolve those claims. Is the department going to be able to? Secondly, Chairperson, I'd like to query the operational costs of this project. In the document, it talks about 579 million rand for operational costs. In a separate report that I received last night, the figure was 1.37 billion rand for operational costs to operationalize this. So I have some queries in that regard. Then I'd like to talk about Clause 5, Subsection 8 of the amendment. In fact, I think it's Clause 5C, sorry. It amends number 8. And that talks about the appointment of acting judges by the Minister of Justice. First of all, I have a little bit of a problem with the fact that the Minister of Justice is appointing the acting judges when all the other judges are appointed by the President. But I'd like to inquire why we are doing away with the time restriction that is put in place for acting judges. In other words, in the existing legislation, it makes provision for a one-month period. And I'd like to know why we are doing away with that time restriction, because as it stands, as the amendment will stand, it allows for someone to be appointed for an indefinite period. There's an acting judge for it. Then, Chairperson, my last point goes to Clause 7 of the Amendment Bill, which deletes Clause 23 of the existing legislation. And one of the things that Clause 23 talks about qualifications of a judge of the court. It says that no person shall be appointed to be president of the court or a judge of the court unless he or she is A, a South African citizen, B, is a fit or proper person to be a judge of the court, C, is a judge of the Supreme Court or is qualified to be admitted. So far, I don't have a problem because all that is covered in the appointment of judges. Where I do have a problem is 23C2, which this clause is now going to delete. 23C2 says, by reason of his or her training and experience, has experience in the fields of law and land matters relevant to the application of this Act and the law of the Republic. Which would seem to me a logical criteria, a logical qualification for someone to be appointed as a judge of the Land Claims Court. Why are we wanting to delete that particular paragraph of the existing legislation? Thank you, Chairperson.
Honourable Mandela.
Thank you, Chair. Let me appreciate the presentation made, Chairperson, by the department. But draw our attention, Chairperson, to slide 7, whereby I would want to first applaud the department for the recognition of ensuring that they are able to accommodate claims by the descendants of the Khoi and the Sen, as well as the heritage sites and historical landmarks. But I think what is of concern and alarming to me speaks particularly to traditional leaders and the traditional councils, particularly when you are looking at communal land, Chairperson. Therefore, I would like to know from the department in terms of what they are exploring around the exceptions of the June 1913 cutoff date. What about traditional leaders and traditional councils and communal land that was lost pre-1913? What is to be done with that? Why are we only recognizing the Khoi and the Sen and not traditional leaders in their entirety? Thanks, Chairperson.
Thank you very much. Just a few comments. Sorry,
Chairperson, over to you. Thank you. And I would also like to appreciate the presentation. Firstly, Chairperson, I want to establish from the department how is their approach going to be on the claims that are stored presently by new claims on the same land, because there are claims that are still not finalized, and when we reopen this time, there are going to be some people that were left out, that feel left out, that are going to want to claim on the very same land, which means it will be an overlapping of claims on the same land. My second question is to find out what is the department going to do to deal with the invasion of land that is being claimed or that is in the process of being claimed, because when people get to understand that the lodgement of land claim is going to be reopened, then people start invading land in order to, overtake the process so that they become the first people to be considered when it comes to development. My third question is, how is the department planning to deal with land that is going to be claimed, but at the same time you discover that the municipality is in the process of selling the same land privately, because this becomes a problem, a very big problem for the department and for us. The last one is on how are we going to approach ensuring that when a claim is successful, no private individual is going to hijack that claim, that land. We have to ensure that we put measures to ensure that no one is going to take advantage of the people that are not able to move faster enough or are not in the know of how to go forward, to move forward with the land that has been successfully restored to them, and hijack the very same land. Thank you, Chairperson.
Okay, thank you, Madam Honourable Members. Just very briefly, because I think many issues have been covered, let me just put emphasis. The first point is, in terms of the support of the successful claimant, because I think this first period of claiming should have taught us one or two lessons. And it seems to me from our interactions with successful claimants, because I think we should use successful claimants to measure how we should proceed in the second phase. Now, do we have adequate support for them? And how do we deal with ensuring that this land that is under consideration for restitution remain productive, so that the value of that land, by the time it is sort of handed over to a successful claimant, the value hasn't taken a dip? I'm raising this thing because these are some of the challenges that we are encountering right now. The second point that I want to make is, there is this complaint by especially people who own the land that is being claimed, who are big commercial farmers, who argue that as a result of things still unresolved on the land, it affects the productivity of the land, they are not able to access loans and so on and so forth, which to a large extent affect the production of food for market purposes, which impact on the economy. What mechanisms we put in place to ensure that as these processes continue, the value of the land remains affected in a way, because whether the claim is successful or not, what is produced on the land becomes, continue to be a very important thing, because it's good for economic growth. The second point I want to raise is around the issue of claims which are settled and those which are finalized.
is it possible to make a simple determination that says once a claim has been settled and finalized, we cannot reopen sort of claim on that kind of land? Because otherwise, my fear is, let's say for example, within the second movement, you have the majority of the claims coming from people who are complaining about land which has been restored to other people. It's like doing the same thing over and over again. So I'm just saying, allowing claims to be made on the land which has been finalized and settled can have its own disadvantages. And how do we then ensure that it doesn't actually push back our idea of making sure that land is actually given to the people? And this issue of second lodgement, I understand that many people are saying it's a problem that lasted for 100 years and more, therefore even the process of addressing it should take the same period. But I think that it's in our own advantage, I think, as government, to make sure that we deal with this matter and have closure on it, but not complete closure. We can close it, and we can deal with other matters that come using other policy issues as opposed to a complete and blanket opening, because it raises emotions, it creates some kind of instability, if you like. And the first of the matter is an issue that must be resolved. So I'm making a point, therefore, that is it in our interest as government to have it prolonged or to have it shortened, this second phase, and look at financial implications and looking at other measures outside this emotive opening of lodgement exercise to deal with these other issues that we will come out. I'm raising this thing because you're speaking about the budget that we've just, estimated budget that we've just raised, about 129 and 179 billion rand, so it's quite a lot of money. And the fact of the matter is, I don't think even within the next 5 years we'll be able to deal with all these matters. So I think we must develop, moving forward, a long-term way of dealing with these things, but at least it must give us, as Parliament and government, an opportunity to be able to have an incremental kind of approach in dealing with this matter. So I'm just saying, if we don't have an approach that gives us this long-term view, we are going to end up having to come back after 2018 to say where do we go from here. So I'm just saying, as the government, as the department actually thought about some kind of long-term view of how we deal with these things even after this second judgment have been concluded. And finally, would it be possible for us to get this regulatory impact assessment? Because it is a very important piece of paper. And I think it would be good if the committee can be given that kind of assessment so we can go through it and also benefit from it. Thank you. I will give an opportunity to respond.
Thank you, Honourable Chair. Can I just say that the whole team will attempt to answer, and if there is a question that we will forget because we've got quite a number of questions, we'll appreciate to that if the Honourable Member can remind us. Thank you.
Thank you. Honourable Chair and Honourable Members for the question. we will attempt to respond to all of them. We are mindful of time as we do that. the old claims that are outstanding, the Commission is going to continue processing those claims. What was done in the past was that the lodgement of claims was a manual process. Claims were lodged using claim forms, and those claim forms were even photocopied and distributed, and claimants would just sometimes fill the claims on their own, providing the information that they thought was required. This time around, we have developed, and the system is now been finalized, a lodgement system that is going to capture the claims as they are. They are being lodged. The information relating to the claims that have been processed is going to be uploaded. So for an example, if a person claims land that has already been restored to someone else, the system will be able to pick up all of those details. And as we continue with the process of reverting claims, which I'm going to expand on later, we will then be uploading information into the system. It will be an important tool to assist in decision making, even on a claim specific basis. We are currently doing a process of communicating with the claimants, with the owner of land that has been claimed, giving them the status of the claim and reassuring them that if the claims are to be reopened, that the claims in their land are going to be processed, that they are going to be prioritized. Obviously, if there is someone else claiming the land, we would then have to look into that land as well. We indicated earlier that the core functions of the Commission are to solicit the claims, to investigate the claims, and to attempt to resolve them through mediation and negotiation. In these processes, the most important element is the research element, the investigation of the case. And that is where we have identified that our witnesses lie. We have then proactively entered into partnerships. We have partnered with the Human Sciences Research Council. They have conducted a diagnosis of exactly what the challenges are and have proposed measures through which these challenges must be addressed. We are also partnering, and this is part of the recommendations, with universities and other research institutions that will provide support to the Commission in the investigation of claims and in field transfer to the officials of the Commission. One of the approaches being considered is a district-based investigation approach. Rather than investigating one claim at a time, let's consider investigating the land in a particular district. Then once we have a proper history of the land in the district, then we can consider all of the claims. We think that is going to assist in dealing with overlapping claims, in dealing with claims on land that has already been restored to communities and to persons. The regulatory impact assessment is a requirement when legislation is proposed. It looks at various issues, and what the department required to be addressed was the issue of the number of claims that are likely to come and the financial implications of those claims. The development economists struggled that were part of the team that drew up the report. They themselves struggled to come up with the results that are contained in the assessment report. But they indicate in the report that this is an estimate, and the estimate is based on the land, the cost of the land that we have acquired to date, and that is why they said to us they can only limit their estimation on 15 years, because that is how long it has taken to deal with the number of claims that have been dealt with so far. So when it came then to coming out and saying how much is this going to cost, we do not know how much, as is indicated in the memorandum, explanatory memorandum to the bill, but the estimate from development economists that were consulted is that the figure will be between 129 billion and 179 billion. The people that were consulted as part of the evaluation included beneficiaries, people who lodged claims and they benefited, included people who did not claim, who are not part of, for example, a communal property association or part of a household that is benefiting, but who have said that we belong with those that are members of that communal property association. So we anticipate that a large majority of the claims that are going to be lodged are claims that are going to be settled without a requirement to acquire additional land. So it's people who are going to be incorporated in existing communal property associations and other structures that have been established to receive land. Obviously, we are not saying claims are going to be only on the land that has been restored, but we think that there will be a significant percentage of the claims that will require government to then add beneficiaries onto existing lists of beneficiaries, and we will certainly make the regulatory impact assessment available to this house. The organizational implications, 52 lodgement sites, those are the current offices of the department. Because of this electronic system, which is a web-based electronic system, it will require information technology connections. These 52 offices have already been connected, and that will basically be phase one. To the extent that we will be able to secure offices in municipal, in offices of municipalities with the necessary connections, then the lodgement stations will then be rolled out first. But at the most minimum, we are going to use all the offices of the Department of Health Development and Land Reform, which already have the infrastructure that is required. And then as the process gets rolled out, then we will look at partnering with municipalities that will have capabilities of hosting our system. The additional officials that are going to be employed, we are going to try as much as possible to follow the same recruitment principles that we follow for our NARISEC program of trying to get people to assist with the lodgement of claims in their local area. These officials are going to be brought in, are going to be trained, and they will then assist together with other youth from the NARISEC program that are going to assist in the actual lodgement of claims, obviously with the necessary supervision. The numbers that have been that are contained in the presentation relating to the number of officials have taken all of those matters into account. On the cost, whether we have or whether the country will have the money, we have engaged National Treasury in as part of going to cabinet. We had to consult various clusters of directors general, and in at least two of the clusters, the Director General of National Treasury was asked whether there is money, and the Director General said there is nothing, that the National Treasury will just have to find the money. It's a constitutional requirement. Restitution is, as we indicated, a requirement in Section 25(7). Of the Constitution, and the requirement for a closing date for lodgement of the claim is actually found in the Restitution Act and not in the Constitution. And a question which we were asked during, or that was posed, which was a bit rhetorical, in the consultations was, on the cost, what would the cost of not doing it be? Of not extending restitution to those who could not participate, if it is not done, what will the cost of that be? The exact date is something that we struggle with on a daily basis. Even officials that are working on various projects that are meant to support the proposed reopening, they require that date so that everything can be properly aligned, so that on the first day of lodgement, everything is done and ready, and it is a matter that we struggle with. As correctly indicated, the process will depend on the processing of the bill. The reopening can only be done by an amendment, an amendment of the legislation that we currently have. We were instructed in February that the bill must be enacted and claims must be lodged by the 19th of June this year. When the country marked the centenary of the Native Land Act, people must be able to lodge claims. And obviously because of processes that have to be undertaken when legislation is being developed, that could not take place. Stakeholders that consulted required additional time to consider and make representations, there were consultations, etc., leading us to where we are present. But our principles, as the Chair correctly pointed out, are desirous of that this piece of legislation must be enacted as soon as possible. We have spoken to the issues of capacity. Obviously, research is not just the only field that will be required, but as and when we get to a point where capacity is not sufficient, we will then look at alternative ways to supplement the income, to supplement the capacity that currently exists both in the Commission and in the Department as a whole. Before 2009, when we were still an entity of Land Affairs, one of the diagnoses that was given to Land Affairs was that the different branches were working in isolation to each other. So with the establishment of the Department of Rural Development and Land Reform, attempts have been done to integrate the work that the department does. In as much as you are processing a land claim, you do need assistance and special skills from other branches within the department, and that is currently being done. The implementation models that have been developed and are implemented, and those will assist in the supplementing of the capacity within the processing of the claim. The claim will be processed simultaneously in a way. There is a prioritization criteria that we have developed. Those who lodged before the cut-off date of 1998, those claims must be processed first. They have been waiting since then. And obviously, when we then discover that there are other people, or when we publish in the district and in the province and in national media, that there is a claim and other people come forward, we will then process all of those claims together. And we think that if we can get research correct, then we'll be able to deal with issues that will come from competing claims. The National Development Plan in Chapter 6 proposes the establishment of what it calls District Land Reform Committee. Those committees, the department is in the process of establishing, and they are going to play a very important role when it comes to competing and overlapping claims. The District Land Reform Committees are going to be local people who would have knowledge of the area, and together with research that would be done, they would then be required to assist where there are disputes relating to entitlement, and that would be incorporated into the broader system of the Commission's role insofar as trying to find alternative dispute resolution mechanisms of resolving claims. At this point in time, there are going to be 9 mobile units, one per province, that are going to assist in reaching the most remote of areas, and the number 5 was a number that has been agreed on, but after further engagements within the department, the number has been increased now to 9, so 1 per province. Apologies for that. Informing people is going to be key, so that we do not repeat what was done in the past. In the past, there was an extensive stake your claim campaign, that is what it was called. The lodgement period was extended 3 times. And each time it was because it was thought that not a sufficient number of people have lost claims. There were still people who did not lodge claims, and one of the reasons was they didn't know. So between June and December 1990, there was that was the last extension. There was an extended stay of claim. Government and its partners, NGOs, they went out to try and reach communities, to try and reach people to claim, but that was not sufficient. So we have been instructed by Cabinet that we must develop, together with government communication and information system, a comprehensive communication campaign. And central to that campaign is going to be a door-to-door campaign handing over a manual, a citizen's manual, which contains information about qualifications, where to claim, how to claim, and what happens once you have lodged a claim. And that process is taking place so that we have a proper communication strategy once it is required. The exception, as indicated in the State of the Nation address, there were proposals, there are proposals to reopen the lodgement of claims. Then there are exceptions to be explored, and part of the exploring of the exception requires that question be asked. And questions have indeed been asked already about the exception. We are saying the exception for the COI and the FEN defendants, and they are to the 1913 current date, so that means that there will be an exception to the rule to allow the COI and the FEN defendants to lodge claims before dispossession, before 1913. That requires legislation. Whether it requires constitutional amendment is a matter that is still going to be considered, whether you actually need a constitutional amendment to achieve that. The exceptions will also cover heritage sites and historical landmarks, and that's for everyone. So the defendant of the COI and the FEN will be able to claim, and then everyone will also be able to claim before 1913 in terms of these exceptions, to the extent that they are claiming historical landmarks and heritage sites. Now, what about communal land? What about this? What about these other types of ethnic groups, etc.? Those are the questions that are being asked, and they have to be asked as part of this exploring exercise that is currently being done. We have said earlier that this is a complex, it is very, very, very complex. We have established a national reference group for the COI and FEN communities and structures that is being engaged on the exception. We are also going to be engaging the National House of Traditional Leaders, the Department of Traditional Affairs, to try and really explore these exceptions and exchange ideas and conduct research and develop policy proposals that will then be presented to government at a later stage. The municipalities, like we have indicated, when it comes to lodgement, we are looking at the infrastructure, whether they will have the infrastructure to support the system for lodgement, and those that will have, we will then engage them and see whether we cannot establish an office there for the creation of the lodgement of the claim. The amount of 549 million is just for operational costs. It is not included in 129 to 179 million. That was just an analysis looking at the ratios between claimants choosing land and financial compensation and playing a little bit. Members will see in the regulatory impact assessment exactly how those numbers were arrived at. The information on the number of valid claims, the 397,000, a little bit more information will come out of that. What the development economists did, assumptions that they took in arriving at the decision. Alternative relief is anything that is not restoration. The courts have said, the Constitutional Court very recently has said, people lodge claims, their main aim is the restoration of land. Alternative relief will then be when they get alternative land, where they get financial compensation when they get any other thing that is not the return of their land. And municipalities, those who sell land privately, that is claimed, there is a decision in the Constitutional Court that we have engaged Salgaon, that we have engaged municipalities through the provincial departments that is responsible for local government to sensitize them on where in the Eastern Cape, in the town of Mthatha, the municipality made land that was being available for development purposes, and then later went to court and said court must order that land is not restorable. And the Constitutional Court ordered that the land is restorable. If the municipality or government wants to develop the land, they can only do so after having consulted with the people and have reached an agreement with the people. The implications in that particular transaction are huge for the municipality. They were sued for damages because they did not follow the correct process, which is very clear set out in the Restitution Act. The current owners of claimed land, they are being engaged on a continuous basis by the department and by the minister in particular. They are members of the minister's reference groups. Every policy that is developed, they are consulted on. Well, this issue of restitution being seen as an impediment to development, the bank not providing loans when the security that is going to be used is land that is claimed. Being dealt with. We are engaging with the banking association to try and see how we can get the banking sector to support the program by treating the land better than what they are doing now. The way they are behaving, you would swear that when there is a claim, then government comes and takes the land and we pay compensation, when compensation is in fact being paid. The methodology that will be it was said by those who missed, who did not claim, that the methodology was poor. How are we going to prevent this? It's going to be communication. The communication campaign, just like when the registration weekend is coming, everyone knows that today is the registration weekend. So we are going to use strategies similar to what is being done elsewhere. It's been 20 years since the last time people had lodged claims. And over the 20 years, people have become aware of their rights, they've become aware of problems of government. Just quickly on a few other issues, particularly the one relating to the judges. Like we said, for the purposes of developing jurisprudence, you require qualified people to sit in that court. You require skilled people to sit in that court, and as the court considers every case, there must be all the necessary skills that are required. And when the court sits and considers a matter that is not a matter of law, that is a matter that requires analysis of the facts, the looking of anything other than just pure legal argument, then they are required to sit with an assessor. The list of assessors is developed by the Minister of Rural Development and Land Reform in consultation with the judge president of the Land Claim Court. And that list contains the people who have skills, experience, and qualification relating to land matters. So when you pair the judge and the assessor, you then get exactly the types of skills that are required by the present section 23.1 that has been referred to. Yes, it's the deletion clause. The clause that is deleted is incorporated by the requirement that is covered by the requirement that a judge must be a high court judge, and then finally that there must be assessors, which are referred to in section 28 and 29 of the Restitution Act. The period for SC, a normal case for restitution, and this is my last point, a normal case for restitution takes on average 3 years. So if you have a judge acting only for a period of 1 month, they will just start part-head matter. And they will listen to matter, the period will lapse, and then that will lead into challenges. The appointment of acting, the judge's president don't like to have acting judges for a long time. So the period is always a reasonable period. And when discussions were held with the Department of Justice, they proposed that we must not limit the appointment period, and obviously an acting capacity, when a person is appointed in an acting capacity, it's not meant to be a permanent appointment.
Thank you, Honourable Jay. Just a last comment, just to say that in terms of just addressing the issue of land invasions on claimed land, it's important to note that if the land is privately owned, that the expectation is that the normal eviction processes are then instituted to try and protect the land. If it's land that belongs to us, we then institute application to evict, so that to ensure that the land is kept for the claiming communities. But there are, however, instances where by the time we come on board, the land is already invaded, and we then have to work with the municipality to try and find alternatives in respect of that land. But each case is then assessed according to its merits, and the decisions are then made based on the facts that are there on the ground. And Honourable Chair, I just wanted to say that we are very concerned of the fact that we've got outstanding claims that we still have to deal with while we are presenting an opportunity for reopening. We have learned lessons from the old system, and we want to do things differently in the new system. And again, as Tammy Mdonso said, we want to make sure that we are not going to be releasing claim forms specifically for the reason of fraud, and also trying to manage the settlement of claims through our electronic system. That's why we also are saying that we will go to the rural areas to make sure that we give every person an opportunity to lodge. So we're not going to wait for the old gogos to come to us. We will go to them. We'll announce specific dates where the mobile units will be visiting the area, so that we can lodge the claim for them. And again, communication is going to be priority, so that people don't feel the pressure to come all on the first day. And also, we also want to make sure that as we move in terms of the researching, identifying the land that is under claim immediately, being able to identify whether it's private or state-owned, being able to identify whether it's already been claimed or not, the nature of the land and so forth is something that we want to do up front. We are fortunate in the sense that we've got the deeds office, we've got surveyor general's office as part of the department, and we want to make sure that we use the capability that they have, so that we immediately, if the person lodges, we're able to identify all of those things, so that our research is quicker, and our electronic system will also help to allow us to monitor the progress of claims, so that we don't find ourselves sitting with claims that can be immediately resolved, sitting for a long time, because we don't have proper operating procedures in place. So we have identified some of the lessons, and we are wanting to implement and do things differently. Thank you.
Thank you. Can we just have a few follow-ups before we wrap up? Honourable Mandela, Swate, Jebekul, Barend, and Ngwenya Mabila. Is that what that? Let's keep our questions and follow-up a little bit short and sharp at the point.
Thank you, Chair. But mine is not a follow-up. My question wasn't answered in terms of the coin, the sand, and why are we confining ourselves to that and traditional leaders in general and traditional councils who have lost communal land. So I'd like to have that question answered, Chair. Thanks.
Thank you very much, Anderson. Mine is a follow-up question with regard to the electronic system vis-a-vis the manual form system that was used before when they started with the enlargement. I just want to find out with regard to that, are they actually, have they taken those manual farms to put them in the system so that when these new people will be coming to the system, they already have those who have actually lost their claims before. I'm saying this because I'm quitting actually the status. Because somebody has complied. And there is these people coming thereafter who are saying that they didn't actually, they had some problems, so they didn't lodge the claims in time. So that's why this has been opened. So you remember, if that actually is not actually addressed, it might actually cause a problem. Because when we look at the issue of those who have claimed and are given those land, and their claims have been finalized, now new people are coming, and there are already new structures, those people, CPAs and others. They know that their claims have been finalized, is sealed, and they've got everything intact. So I just want to know the status with regard to that. That's why I'm asking this question as a follow-up. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chair. Mine as well is not corrupt. I just want to inquire from the department. Since we've experienced the fact that the claimants, the claimants have lost claims on land that is occupied by other communities, what does the department have in place to address those issues? I think it's one of the challenges, the cases in Limpopo where we've seen that. Secondly, the employees of the Land Claims Commission. Chairperson, the experience one has is that in the office of the Land Claims Commission, we find that an employee who's deployed to work in a certain district or a certain municipality is holding files for certain communities. When they make a follow-up, they find that he or she is no longer there. Then somebody has been sort of employed to handle those files. And the other person does not come and set him or herself to the community so that they proceed working with them on the files. What does it have in place to address those? And the attitude as well, because there is a problem of attitude in land claims commission offices of the officials showing no respect and give no attention to the claimants when they come to the offices. What does the department have in place to address those?
Thank you, Jefferson. There was a previous commitment to provide honorable members with a full breakdown of the total of claims that was dealt with in this first phase. I would like to know, do we still need to wait for that, or is it available so that we can get it as soon as possible? For many reasons, I think we are working together and we want to assist where we live. Then the second question is on the speed of the development of the policy, the one that will influence the ability of the Khoi and the San people to claim. The word exploring, it sounds a bit not definite, or as if people will be able to submit a claim, but it may probably not be completed because of the constitutional requirement that is needed, and it cannot be completed thus. Maybe I am incorrect, but I would like to be corrected if I misunderstand it. And the other thing about it is, in case this policy will be late, with late I mean that it's not ready by the end of December this year. The people that will be affected there may probably not participate fully within that 5 years leading up to 2018. That's my question. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. I just want to check my understanding that this amendment that you're tabling to, the amendments are tabling to the committee today, are responding only to one issue, only for those who miss the deadline, December 1998. meaning that you are not, you have partially responded to the call made by President. Because the President highlighted some issues, the Koyanders and the heritage site, historical landmarks. To me, you partially responded to the call. I'm not sure whether you're not supposed to present the policy, that policy that will deal with the exceptions, together with this amendment. So that when you start implementing the amendment, you also deal with those exceptions. Thank you.
Chairperson, thank you. Mine is, it will be a follow-up because I was asking to the department, maybe it's because I forgot to mention the number of the people that I'm asking. So it was in number 6 in the estimation of between 1.1, okay. It was 1.9 to 1.29 billion, and also in the other paper is in number 8. It is number 8, section 3, I didn't get any clarity why the department is contradicting itself in this question, because I was asking why they estimated the amount in other paper, in other paper they said it is not possible to determine what the financial situation will be as a result of extending the period for the lodging of claims for the restitution 31 December 2018. Do you get any knowledge about why the department is telling us the estimation of the amount in other paper in the page 8 here? They didn't tell us why this other paper they said it is not possible to determine, but other paper they said it will be between 129 to 179 billion. I don't know why, because it seems that they are contradicting themselves in this paper. Thank you.
Well, I'm going to give the department the opportunity again to respond. I think even on some of the issues why they feel that they might have responded, they must just really try to give more clarity so they can be a full understanding. But first, I just want to ask a question which I don't know how it relates to your work, but I just want to find out what will be the relationship between what you are doing in terms of this bill and the property valuation bill, which talks about the establishment of the Office of the Valuer General, because for any land that should be dealt with now, it has to be valued because of the decision to move away from the willing buyer, willing seller to a just and equitable principle. So I just want to find out whether are we going to make sure that bill also gets implemented in part as we move forward, because I don't see us moving forward without that piece of legislation also being there. If you can just clarify me on that one. Thank you.
Thank you, Honourable Chair. Just to answer the question around the exceptions, historic landmarks, as well as the COI and the SEN, to acknowledge that the process that was defined by the Honourable President was that we're supposed to reopen land claims, the cut-off date in general. Secondly, we would take into consideration exceptions or the pre-1913 cut-off date, which is the time where after the union became. So we've got the exceptions, we've got the 1913 exceptions that speak to the COI and the fund. heritage and historic landmarks. The Khoi and Sons will be allowed to claim before 1913, but also anything that speaks to heritage and historic landmarks. This covers everybody, and therefore, in our understanding, would be able to deal with the issues around land that was held by traditional leaders or traditional councils. Again, Mr. Johnson did explain that the department, through the leadership of the minister, decided that we had to divide the processes into two, because the first one, which is reopening the 1998 cut-off date, was a straightforward process and one that would have been easy for us to imagine, which is the one that was now presented to this committee. But the second one is taking into consideration the cut-off, the 1913 exceptions, heritage sites, historic landmarks, Khoi and Sons. We are engaging in research. We, again, as I said, have what we call a national reference group that consists of communities representing the Khoi and the Sons from all the provinces. We've got historians who are helping us. As Tami has already indicated, we are engaging various stakeholders, traditional communities, traditional leaders, and others to make sure that we are able to conclusively identify those historic landmarks. Because historic landmarks, for example, can be an area somewhere where inkosi eyaguqela khona. So by default, that becomes a traditional leadership of a community area that would have to be taken into consideration. So when we talk about historic landmarks and cultural landmarks, we are considering that as well. So it's not, it does not exclude traditional leaders or traditional communities. Again, we said that the history that's going to be analyzed is all the history. It's not going to be necessarily defined to the Khoi and Sons history only, but specifically the Khoi and Sons history will be identified because they have been given an opportunity to, in general, claim pre-1913. So that also includes all of that. And remember, again, we're saying we're still engaging with various parties. And so these issues are going to come up as we engage, and we'll then be able to, in a way, formulate policy that will guide us after we've engaged and after we've looked at the research that we have received as the best way forward. And the issues around electronic systems and versus the manual system, we are making sure that we are taking our, we call it the old claims, and we're capturing them into Mhlabawe to make sure that even as the lodgement happens, we're able to interface with information from the old claims and with the information that is being lodged there, so that we're able to identify whether the person who's coming now is someone who's lodged before, whether their identity number actually comes up in the system as someone who's already been, who's already benefited from the process. So those are the issues that we are taking into consideration, which is why, again, we're saying that we are engaging with the DIS offices as well. We are engaging with the Home Affairs to make sure that the system that we will operate will be a live system that will be able to interface between various systems, so that we're able to immediately identify that, okay, this land that is now being claimed is land that has already been restored to a certain group, so that already then we can begin to plan upfront or even communicate to the person who's lodging that issue. It will also help because then we're able to communicate as well with the current landowners, the status, if, for example, they want to know whether the land is under claim or not, we'll be able to deal with that. Remember that Office of the Surveyor General has recently done a land audit, and so we are also wanting to be able to interface with that so that we can be able to identify whether it's state land, private land, who is this private land, the owner of the land. We are acknowledging that in the provinces we've got a lot of work that we need to do, and we also acknowledge that very often the interaction between ourselves and our clients is not very positive at times. We try and encourage that communities or individuals communicate with us when they identify those problems so that we can try and resolve it as quick as possible. But also the system that we are wanting to put on the table in terms of processing the new claims will allow us to better monitor how provinces are processing their claims, because we are not looking just at the lodgement process, but we're looking at the settlement of the claim. And therefore, we're hoping that we'll be able to have various stages of lodgement that are standardized, so that if a claim is sitting at gazetting for too long, we'll be able to know that this claim should have now moved to a stage, and therefore we need to then address those issues with, for example, the project officer or manager dealing with the claim. We are also wanting to make sure that the standard operating policies, we are wanting to communicate with our stakeholders on a much regular basis, so that if there are problems, we are able to identify them as quickly as possible. Again, on whether we should have brought the policy on the pre-1913, we're saying that right now we're not in a position to do so, because we're still engaging on the process, and we want to make sure that the engagement is one that's meaningful, and we just don't do it for the sake of doing it, because there are a lot of issues that we're going to have to deal with. And again, when Tammy says that we are, what is the word? Exploring maybe is a loose word to say that we're engaging with various parties, and it's quite an intense and at times very emotional process. But we're wanting to make sure that we take everybody on board. For example, the Narech, that consists of the various Khoisan groupings, have said that they want to be given an opportunity to actually present their own research from their own perspective. And so we want to be able to give them that opportunity to do that. I think Utapel will respond to the question of the process of the OBG.
Thank you, Chair. The Property Valuations Bill is ready for processing to Cabinet. On the 25th of September, Cabinet had decided that our Minister and the Minister of Public Works were to go and discuss issues that there was not agreement on between the two departments. So the meeting happened on the 2nd of October. Now we've all processed the Cabinet memo again for consideration tomorrow by the Cabinet Committee, a final decision by Cabinet next week, Wednesday, the 25th year. So the expectation is that we will get approval to table next week, Wednesday.
Okay, thank you very much.
Just one question that was not responded to.
Thanks, Chair. Just on the financial implications in the bill, as opposed to the estimates that are in the regulatory impact assessment, the requirement really when we deal with a paragraph in the bill itself is to give a very good sense of what the financial implications are going to be. So the statement that the government is making there is that it's not possible at this stage to give an exact amount that the state will incur in the settling of the claims that will come. So the idea is to say it's unknown now. It will depend on the claims that will come in on an official document like the bill itself. But just to get a sense of the size and the enormity of the task ahead, in the regulatory impact assessment, the economists that worked on it attempted to give us a sense of what it is going to be. If you look at the range, it talks about 129 to 179 billion rands. That just demonstrates how huge it is, but it's not an exact figure, it is not an exact amount, it is indeed going to depend on what we will receive in terms of the in terms of the claims themselves?
Well, honourable members, I think let's appreciate the presentation by the department. And to say that the process have just begun because they have now tabled this thing before ourselves as a committee, we will take it forward, but we'll appreciate if we can get the RIA report, regulated assessment impact report. But secondly, to say, when Tammy opened in the beginning, when he started his presentation, he did say that the process of dispossession did not start on the 19th of June, 1913. It was only legislated on the 19th of June, 1913. It started before that time. And I'm raising this point just to emphasize the point that Honourable Mandela is making, which I think as a committee we will pursue. By the time that disposition was happening, this country was primarily under the leadership of traditional institutions. There were no political formations at the time. And I think that's an acknowledgement of that historical fact. We need to at least put it down on paper, because we are in the process of rewriting history, if you like. Those who come after us must be able to get a sense of what actually prevailed during that time. So we don't have to exclude others. We don't have to go into detail, but just at least acknowledge the fact that they were there, they had a role at that time. And I think that on its own will go a long way in terms of putting the facts, you know, right. Now, moving from here, we are still going to have an opportunity of members to engage on this process. From here, the Secretary will publicize this bill. And I think by the end of, by the beginning of November, that process of publishing would have been satisfied. We will embark on an oversight visit and campaign to talk to our own people also, stakeholders in different provinces on this particular issue, because as we said from the beginning, it is a very emotive issue. It does not need any shortcuts. We have to travel this route straight, no shortcuts, so that at the end, we can have a process which we can say to ourselves, indeed, it addressed almost most of the issues that might have been obstacle to the route. And then obviously, thereafter, we'll have to come back and say to ourselves, what are our experiences? And we might call the department again, come back to us and say, before we actually present this thing as a final as a final call in terms of our consultations, there are certain issues that we may need some clarity from the department. So I'm just saying the door is not completely closed. The department is here, we are here, we are serving the main purpose. By the way, our objective here is to make sure that we provide adequate response to the challenge and bring it to its finality with a view of redressing and addressing the challenge of the land dispossession of 1913. So we are working together as government and as parliament. It is in our best interest to have a final resolution on this matter, and we hope that moving forward, no closure can be reached without having a second bite to make sure that we raise all the necessary questions that we need to raise. But we must not leave anything outside. All the questions that we have raised, then the department will also go back and think about them, because all of us, we want a very good and clean end product. So I just thought we must thank them for taking pains to spend time with us, and they must also forgive us for having, you know, raised so many questions. It's because we also have an interest in the relationship between this issue of land and poverty eradication.
So we are interested in ensuring that we succeed. So thank you very much for your attendance and your participation and your honest presentation and how you responded to some of the questions that raised. We're looking forward to see you again in the near future. Thank you. We are not going to listen to the Auditor General. Yeah, I'll just have 5 minutes break, even after a football game that ended in a draw. They usually break for a few minutes to rearrange themselves for an extra time. So we'll have just 5 minutes break for the Auditor General and a team to get ready. Thank you very much. Let me take this opportunity to welcome the Office of the Auditor General. We are going to receive a briefing from the Office of the Auditor General now. So I hope you enjoyed your short break and your finger lunch. Okay, I'm not opening the discussion for quality of the lunch and how tasty it was, but I'm just opening discussion for the Office of the General to take over and lead us. Over to you.
Thank you, Chair, and good day to you and to the honorable members, colleagues from the department and everybody else present. Chair, it's always an honor and pleasure from the Office of the Auditor General to brief the committee on the outcomes of the rural development portfolio, and that's what we are here to do. Chair, if you'll allow me, I would like to introduce my team on the right. Next to me, I have the audit manager responsible for the audit of rural development, Ben C. And next to him, the senior manager responsible for the rural development portfolio, Eugene Dehan. Eugene will be taking us through the presentation here. And in front of you, Chair, there is a Word document like this. These are the notes giving details of what is in the audit report of the department and entities within the department. And then we have an Excel sheet, which is a presentation, which is where Eugene will be presenting from for ease of reference. Chair, just before we go into the presentation, we have had some sessions before where we spoke about the reporting requirements from the Office of the Auditor General. And I would just like to recap on the terminology that we use so that when Eugene goes through the presentation, then the members can then reflect based on the recap that I'm going to do. And I just want to recap on what clean audit outcomes entail and the type of opinions that we express and what they entail as well. And again, for ease of form member to be able to just reflect and analyze what Eugene will be presenting. Chair, you recall that a few years ago, government had an initiative of clean audit outcomes by 2014, which is the year that we are in. Now, what are clean audit outcomes? Chair, we report on three areas in the audit report. We report on finances, and we express an opinion on the financials of departments and entities. And I'll talk about the opinions at a later stage. And then we report on predetermined objectives. However, we express an opinion in the management report and not in the audit report. So in the audit report, what you will find is factual findings that would have led to a specific opinion. Now, what I'm saying is, if in the management report there is a qualification, a disclaimer of opinion, or an adverse opinion, then you will find findings in the audit report. However, if in the management report we have expressed an unqualified opinion on predetermined objectives, there will be no findings in the audit report. And then we report on compliance with rules and regulations. And on compliance with rules and regulations, we do not express an opinion. However, we will report on material non-compliance in the audit report. So we focus on three areas in the audit report. So when you talk about clean audit outcomes, all three areas must not have findings. And then we say an entity or a department has clean audit outcomes. Now, having said that, as the AG, we identified five focus areas, which we are saying they are an impediment to clean audit outcomes. And these three areas are predetermined objectives, which is service delivery, compliance rules and regulations, where we always have findings specifically related to supply chain, HR management, and we are saying that without skilled labor force, qualified, committed, you will not be able to deliver clean audit outcomes because the three areas that we report on will not be clean because you don't have skilled and qualified staff. IT is the means that we use to produce financial statements and reports on predetermined objectives. So if the IT systems that you use do not support you to produce reliable and credible information, you definitely will not be able to achieve what you're talking about. And we refer to material adjustment to the financial statements. The reason being that we actually report on material adjustments to the financial statements if they arose as a result of lack of internal controls within a department or an entity. There are material adjustments that might arise because they are technical in nature. For instance, there is different interpretation to the accounting standard. In that instance, we say it's not due to lack of control, and therefore we will not report the adjustment as a non-compliance, as a material adjustment. However, if the adjustment arose because management did not implement proper controls or did not make sure that people are sent for training or are properly qualified and skilled, then we will raise the material adjustment to the financial statement. The other thing that we will, the other reason why we will raise it is that when we raise the finding, we also indicate what the root cause is. And the recommendation is that the entity or the department must draw up an action plan to address the root cause. What normally happens is the entities and the departments, in most cases, they will address the findings and not the root cause. If I can give an example, if you take the supply chain, for instance, the PFMA requires the accounting authority and the accounting officer to prevent occurrence of irregular expenditure. And there are certain things that need to be complied with. If they are not, then the expenditure might result in irregular expenditure. What we find happening more and more is that entities and departments, they identify regular expenditure before we come and audit, and they disclose it. And therefore, the fact that they have identified and disclosed all irregular expenditure, they think that they have addressed the finding. But the issue is we need to make sure that irregular expenditure is presented before it even occurs. That's why we're saying they're addressing the finding and not the root cause. So they are not making sure that there are proper controls to avoid irregular expenditure. Now, Chair, I've committed to talk about the different audit opinions. And this will illustrate what we mean again by the audit outcomes. The first excellent opinion that we give, and that's where we give a green, is unqualified financial opinion with no findings, which means the findings are clean because the audit report is unqualified and there are no findings in determined objectives, there are no findings in compliance with rules and regulations. And then the second one that we talk about is unqualified with findings. Now in this instance, you will find that the financials are unqualified and there are findings on predetermined objectives and or on compliance with rules and regulations. The next one would be a qualified opinion. A qualified opinion means that the financials are qualified. So there is an element within the financial statement that we do not agree with or that we could not express an opinion on, but we could ring fence it. And more often than not, if the financial statements are qualified, you'll find that there will be findings on treatment objectives and compliance with rules and regulations. The next one is an adverse opinion. This means that we are issuing an adverse opinion on the financials, and it means that we do not express an opinion because of certain disagreements in how management has accounted for the financials, which we are of the opinion that contradicts accounting standards. And then the last one is a disclaimer of opinion where we are unable to express an opinion because we were not able to audit or verify the validity of the financial statements because supporting documentation was not submitted to us. So that's its own limitation. And again, when we issue an adverse opinion or a disclaimer of opinion, you will find that there are always findings on predetermined objectives and compliance with rules and regulations. So, Chair, in short, that's what I wanted to just recap so that members can then bear that in mind as we go through the presentation. You will find that the portfolio for rural development is in the second category, which is unqualified with findings. But now, if we look at achievement of clean audit outcomes by 2014, which is this current year, we as the rural development portfolio be able to achieve this target that was set for us. In my personal opinion, it is possible. There are some things which have quick fixes, which the department can look at. There are things that are repeating, which means that we are not paying much attention to them. And yes, there definitely is still time for us to resolve some of these things. And unfortunately, when it comes to non-compliance, if we haven't addressed the issues of non-compliance by now, we already have way through the year. We will still have those issues. And history has taught us that where departments draw up exception plans, implementation is much later in the year, and it will happen around January. Then for the 9 months of the year, there has been non-compliance. However, we need to see the difference in the 3 months, and it will fully show in the following year. So we still urge our portfolios to then focus on these quick fixes, so that we can then see the results. The question that normally arrives from the departments is that we are aware of the initiatives that they have put in place trying to address some of the findings that we have reported, and we do not report on this. But the challenge is that even though an effort has been made to address the findings that have been made, the audit is looking at the positive impact that we have had in our findings. So if we identify findings that are material and we report on these, it clearly indicates that the efforts and the initiatives were fruitful, and perhaps we need to go back to the drawing board and develop actions that will make a visible and tangible difference to the outcomes of the department. With that, Chair, allow me to hand over to you, Chief. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mary.
Good afternoon,
Chair, members, and the department. I'll be taking you through the two documents. The one document is called Briefing to the Portfolio Committee on the 12-13 audit outcomes. The other one is called the PC Briefing Note. If you first refer to the first document, the presentation document, we'll go to the second page. Our reputation promise refers to the Auditor General of South Africa and the constitutional mandate, and as Supreme Audit Institution of South Africa exists to strengthen our country's democracy by enabling oversight, accountability and governance in the public sector through auditing, thereby building public confidence. If we can move to two pages on to the document that states got a heading of all outcomes, 12-13 DRD and LR portfolio. This document. What I'll be doing is I'll be doing the department and the entity separately. As you can see on this document, there are cells highlighted in blue and in yellow. And then there's little numbers in those cells. Those numbers refer to the page numbers in a briefing document for ease of reference. Okay, if we can start with the Department of Rural Development. On the audit outcomes, you'll see that they have improved. They improved from last year. They had a qualification on movable assets. Currently, they have managed to resolve that qualification, and it was moved to other matters. Then, if we move to the findings on predetermined objectives, you'll see that they have findings on predetermined objectives regarding usefulness and reliability. If we move to usefulness in the briefing document on page 6, on usefulness was regarding presentation, where we couldn't verify the supporting evidence substantiating the variances explained. That the findings on consistency between the changes to objective indicators and targets not approved. We also found that the reported targets are not consistent with planned targets. In that finding, the findings on measurability, performance indicators not well defined in terms of the SMART criteria. If we move to page 10 on the briefing document, talk about the reliability for the department. We found for program 3 and 5 that we could not verify the achievements reported as being accurate and complete. If we move to findings on compliance of laws and regulations, talks about the strat plan, page 12 for the department. Everybody still following? You guys lost. Okay. Yes. I'll be referring between the two documents. As you can see in this document, the page numbers in the blue, which refer to the briefing note document for a more detailed. For compliance of laws and regulations for the department, we identify strategic planning and management performance and strategic planning and performance management on compliance as the department does not have a specific appropriate information system to enable it to monitor the progress made towards achieving the goals, targets and core objectives as indicated in the strategic plan as required by the public service. regulations. We also identified non-compliance to the annual financial statements in terms of the PFMA. This was regarding to the material adjustments that were made to financial statements. Then we also identified our expenditure management. The accounting does not take effective steps to prevent irregular, fruitless, and wasteful expenditure as required. This relates to irregular expenditure being incurred by the department. Then regarding human resource management and compensation, we also identified some senior management staff of the department did not have performance agreements and certain employees did not sign performance agreements in current performance periods as required. We also identified regarding human resources, employees were appointed without following a proper verification process to verify the reported achievements in the applications. This all related to compliance, the non-compliance of laws and regulations for the department. Also regarding expenditure management for compliance or non-compliance, if you move to page 28, regarding irregular and fruits and wasteful expenditure, there's a table. If you look at fruits and wasteful expenditure from 11, 12, 12, 13, you'll see there was a big increase from 6 million to 35 million. This was due to interest compelled by the court to be paid on the late settlement of claims. Then if you look at the irregular expenditure, you'll see there was a decrease from 7 million to 5 million, as we noted in an improvement in the supply chain management process of the department. And if we can move to the control environment for the department, page 24 of the briefing notes. This is a summary table of the three different key areas of internal controls, which is split up in leadership, financial performance management, and governance. For the department, compared from the prior year to the current year, there was no movement. There was no movement, as it remained more or less the same. For a more detailed analysis, page 25 speaks to the department's internal control environment between the different specific leadership, financial performance, and governance areas. If you look at it, it's also broken down in the F stands for financial and performance management and compliance. If you look at oversight responsibility, we assess this as being crucial intervention is required, and also proper record keeping and processing and reconciling controls. This all relates to the adjustments made to the financial statements submitted. In regarding performance management, we identified non-effective leadership culture, oversight responsibility, policies and procedures, action plans, proper record keeping, processes and reconciling controls, and reporting all being areas of concern. This was mainly due to the fact that the qualification they received on usefulness and on reliability of performance information. Okay, I'll be moving over to the deeds trading account. If we move to page 3 in the briefing document, you'll see the deeds trading account also improved from the prior year. In the prior year, they had qualification and expenditure and accruals. In the current year, they managed to dissolve their qualification and they received an unqualified opinion with other findings. Regarding performance findings on pre-determined objectives, if we move to page 8 in the briefing notes, they only received a qualification on usefulness in terms of the SMART criteria not being applied, where the targets were not achievable. In findings on compliance of laws and regulations, in terms of supply chain, page 16 in the briefing notes. You will see that the deeds entity, the procurement of consultants, additional Enterprise Agriculture and awarding of the task to complete the regulatory impact assessment did not comply with the risk of procurement process. This was all related to the ICADASCO project. Then we move to expenditure management on page 17 in the briefing notes. We also identified that due to the accounting officer not taking necessary steps, that they did incur irregular expenditure, which is a contravention of expenditure management. In terms of financial statements, I said that several material corrections also made their financial statements submitted, which also caused non-compliance in terms of PFMA. Then if we move to page 21, regarding the HR management for the deed trading entity, we found that the human resource plan was not in place as required by the public service regulation, also non-compliance with the public service regulation. If we move on to the internal controls for the deed entity, on page 24 and 25. If you look at page 24, the summary compared from the prior year to the current year internal control environment, you will notice that leadership and governance remain the same. The financial and performance management went down. This is due to a lot more material adjustments being directed to the financial statements submitted on the 31st of May. 2012. If you go to page 25, you will see the internal control environment for the financial overview, oversight responsibility, HR management and policies regarding leadership is crucial, and then for financial performance management reporting and IT controls also crucial. This is mainly due to the financial statements also being submitted or also being subjected to material corrections. Then regarding compliance, the HR management, which is also crucial, this is regarding the HR plan that is not in place. If we move to the agricultural land holdings account trading entity, you'll see they received an unqualified opinion in the prior year, and they received an unqualified opinion again with findings in the current year, which means they remain the same. Their performance information is being done by the department. They're not responsible for their own performance information. Regarding findings on compliance of laws and regulations, we move to page 15 in the briefing notes, so it talks to the strategic plan. Which states that the accounting officer of Allah did not ensure that the Allah has expected outcomes programs, outcomes indicators and targets are separately identified from that of the department as required by the regulations. Regarding expenditure management, we also identified they incurred some fruitless and wasteful expenditure, which is in non-compliance to the PFMA. Regarding asset management, the accounting officer did not ensure that the entity has effective, efficient, and transparent systems of financial risk management and internal controls for the updated policy as required by the PFMA. Also non-compliance with the asset management. Then again, the financials comes into play again. The financials submitted were subject to material corrections, various material corrections. Then regarding revenue management, we also identified that the accounting officer does not have appropriate steps to collect all money due to the trading entity. This is regarding the leasing system. Then if we move on to the internal control deficiency within HALA or agricultural land holdings account, we move to page 24 and 26. Um, 24 performance management, mainly due to the financial statements being subject to material corrections, various material corrections. Yeah, if we move to page 26, Pakala. I see the areas of concern for financial will be oversight responsibility, policies and procedures, proper record keeping, reconciling, controls, reporting and compliance. This mainly related to the fact that it was subject to material corrections and also policies and procedures either not being developed or policies and procedures not being updated on the, for the new business model. We also identified some problems with proper record keeping in terms of substantiating evidence. Then if we can move on to the Income Yoma Transport. Move to page 4 of the briefing document. The Income Yoma Transport is the only report that received a qualified opinion. It received 3 qualification paragraphs, which is the same in the prior, so means there's been no movement from the prior. They received one on property, plant and equipment regarding the valuation of land. And they received one on royalty revenue regarding the completeness and accuracy of royalty revenue being received and not having a proper system in place. And then also regarding provisions, which don't have appropriate evidence to substantiate the provisions being disclosed. Then if we move to findings on compliance of laws and regulations, page 17 in the briefing document. Talks about first the budgets. The trust accumulated surpluses without approval of National Treasury, which is in contravention of the PFM Act. Expenditure management. Management does not exercise oversight over the funds distributed to traditional councils to ensure compliance with operational policies of the trust. Also asset management, proper controls, and systems to safeguard and maintain removable assets were not implemented as required. That relates to the qualification paragraph on the property, plant and equipment as well. And then the revenue management, the accounting authority does not take effective and appropriate steps to collect all royalty revenue due. It also talks to the qualification paragraph on completeness and accuracy of royalty revenue received. Then if we can move to the internal control environment for Income Yoma Transport, which is on page 24 and 26. You will see that the leadership environment went down. This is regarding management not resolving the pre-qualification areas, and there was no movement from the prior year. The attitude remained exactly the same. If we move to page 26, you will notice that the crucial areas of oversight responsibility, policies and procedures, reporting and compliance for financial. And for compliance, it would be the same. This is all relating to the qualification paragraph not being resolved by management. And if I can take you to, on the briefing document, page 28, the irregular and fruitless wasteful expenditure table. Just need to mention the deeds variance. For fruitless and wasteful expenditure, it was 43 in the prior and 24 in the current year, which means it went down. For the deeds, irregular expenditure, it went from 32 million to 4 million. The main reason is that there was one big payment made to Equidastrio in the prior that was not followed, that didn't follow proper procurement process, which was then regarded as irregular expenditure for the hotel. Then, if we move on with the briefing, the slides documents, you'll see the next page is just a summary of what I've actually explained already regarding the briefing notes. So I'm not going to go through that again. And that's all. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Chair. I just want to touch on a few points that Eugene spoke about. He would have spoken about two opinions on predetermined objectives for the usefulness and for reliability, and I forgot to touch on that. We expressed two opinions when it comes to, in a management report that indicated when it comes to predetermined objectives. Usefulness relates to the SMART principles, whether the objectives and the targets are SMART. So then we'll express an opinion on that. And then on reliability, when we verify reliability, we look at whether the reported performance information is valid. Whether it's valid, whether it's complete, and whether it's accurate. So reliability talks to validity, accuracy, and completeness. And usefulness talks to the SMART principles. So those are the two opinions that we express. You would have seen that over the years, not many departments or entities received clean opinion on usefulness. However, National Treasury has now introduced what they call technical indicators, which means that the entities and departments are required to indicate to the extent that, you know, they identify the data or information that will be used to measure the targets that they have set for themselves. What we have done now, we have reviewed the APPs for 13-14 to, you know, in relation to usefulness, so that departments and entities can then go back and collect these. But what we found is that when we use the information presented to us when we audit usefulness, at face value, it might look okay. But when we go and verify reliability, we find that the data that they used or the supporting evidence that they used to justify what they have reported does not match, which means that in the beginning, the usefulness was not after all what we had seen. So with the technical indicators or the guidance on the technical indicators from National Treasury, we are hoping that it will address this challenge, and we'll be using that for the current financial year. So we will see when we audit the reliability for the 13-14 if these technical indicators have been quite useful. And I just want to take the members to the internal controls that are on page 24 of the sixth document, the word document. Because, as I have indicated, these internal controls, they indicate progress made with regard to achieving clean audit outcomes. What normally happens is that the department and entities will develop an action plan to address the findings raised. However, year on year, we will report on repeat findings. And normally when the department or an entity has some initiative in progress to address the findings, we are saying that there is an intention, something has been started, and then we're given yellow to recognize the effort that they have put in place to address the finding raised. However, if we get repeat findings for two or more years, it is clear that that intention is not moving at all. And with technology and the world changing as it is, it might be that the initiative that they started is now outdated and they might need to go back and develop a new strategy because it didn't bear fruit. And in that instance, they are saying that in that case, the intention of yellow is that within no time you move to green, which means you have addressed the control environment, which will then prevent recurring findings. So if this doesn't happen, then it means you're back to square one because it might result in a qualification. So you need to relook at your strategy. And your initiatives are therefore not bearing fruit. And that's where you will then see these regressions that you see there, because normally that's only because the initiatives didn't bear fruit. So that that's the concern that we said we have. And then, as Eugene indicated, we look at the three areas of leadership, and the leadership will talk to their skills, the competencies of the people, policies and procedures, whether the policies and procedures implemented are effective or not. And then we talk about financial and performance management, which will talk to the disciplines, the daily reconciliations, weekly, monthly reconciliations, supporting evidence, whether it's readily available or not. Because this is the greatest area that will result in material adjustments for financials. I can also give you an example. In most entities where they have disclaimer of opinion, this comes at a huge cost, and it's unnecessary, because you find that the entity will say, no, we do have documents, we'll go look for them, and then you wait, and then so you do an interim audit for you to raise red flags so that management can go and address. You come at final, which is May, June, and July, to do the final audit, and you still have the same problems. And in fact, if management was in a position to perform a self-assessment and acknowledge the weaknesses in the systems and indicate where they have proper documents and where they do not, the audit process would be smooth and without pain. If you look at the area of material adjustments as well, this would be areas that we would, in some cases, audit more than six times. Because you'll get a schedule that you ordered, and then you get findings, and then they go back and correct. Give you a new schedule. You select a different sample, because in terms of the auditing standards, you cannot go back to the sample that you have selected, because it's a sample of a population. So if you make findings, then the auditee needs to go back and correct the whole population. Now, they will resubmit, and then you select a different population. You find the same issues. You send it back, they go and correct. They give you a new schedule, you select a new sample again. And then you still find findings. And then you say, no, I've audited this three times already. I cannot, one more chance. I promise you it will be fine. So this is basically what happens. And what we are saying is, if the financial and performance management processes were in place and there are these daily disciplines, and people are held accountable and give assurance on a daily basis that they have done what they should have done. And again, even if individual gives assurance that I have done my responsibility for the day, they should be aware of their responsibilities. And it goes back to HR management, where in terms of the HR management, each person needs to have a performance contract that indicates what they need to be doing, what is expected of them, and what role do they play in achieving the strategic objectives of a department or an entity. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. Okay. Are we going to get the second? Is he going to present or something?
Okay.
Done. Okay. That is the presentation, our members. Are there any papers? Madam?
Chairperson, my question is not to the AG's office, but rather to the department. And that is, a number of significant issues have been identified here. And I'd really like to know what steps are being taken to address those issues. In particular, with regard to the performance objectives, that is a major area of concern, and just a brief glance, and I have to admit that I only received the annual report sitting in meetings, so I haven't had a chance to go through it in detail, but I counted 12 out of 26 performance objectives achieved, and even on those that you achieved, what we're hearing from the AG is that the reliability is questionable. So my question to the department is, what are they going to do to address that issue? Chairperson, I understand that we will be addressing the Ngonyama Trust tomorrow. Is that correct? I'll leave the questions regarding that to that discussion then. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Chair.
Honorable Gwena Mabila.
Thank you, Chair. You will correct me if I'm wrong. Chair, I thought that today there is a briefing by the AG briefing the committee on the findings. Then tomorrow, then we'll be having a meeting with the department where we'll be dealing with the annual report together with the findings of the Auditor General's office. So I'm not sure whether we're to engage on the presentation by the AG asking questions that are related to the department now, or we should pass that until tomorrow's meeting. But we can ask the questions that are relevant to watch the AG, maybe to understand some of the things that have been raised by the Auditor General now.
Well, you are right in that tomorrow there will be a presentation by the department on the whole question of the annual report. We have received a briefing from the office of the AG. I think other members, if they do have questions that they want to raise to the office of the AG, they can do so, but bear in mind that the real discussions will take place tomorrow where the department will be presenting, and I think it will be the department that will be able to answer some of the questions that the AG has raised, because the AG can't speak on behalf of the department. It can only indicate what are the weaknesses of the department in terms of financial, you know, management and other related issues. Because there will be also a middle person here, or a middle man, if you like, performance and monitoring department, which also, in a way, will have to play a part in terms of how it intervened, how it tried to assist, and so on. But you're right, honorable member, that the purpose of the briefing was actually to indicate to us as to what the office of the AG has done, what are their findings. But the real meaty questions can be left for tomorrow when we engage the department. But for now, please raise whatever you want to raise for the office of the AG.
Thank you,
Honorable
Sir. In page 28 of the briefing notes, in Ngonyama Trust Board, irregular expenditure and forgetful with the expenditure. You know, in the department and other entities, there are figures, there is 0-0. You can explain what's going on here. And I see yellow, which means there's something wrong, which is all green, and there are 0-0.
Any further questions? Is that all? Very much, you know. I'm going to
the person, while the office of the AG was presenting, I had something about the technical indicators. Maybe if you can be clarified about that, because usually when we engage with the departments or entities at the beginning of the financial year, I'm happy because you have just indicated the issue of the SMART principle, that they are planning to be specific, measurable, reliable, whatever. But in most cases, you'll find an indication from the departmental side that according to the Treasury, for instance, according to my understanding, the SMART plan must be submitted at the end of each and every term. The APP annual performance plan must talk to the stress plan. It must be submitted annually, which will assist the committee to oversight, which must be clear, you know, measurable, so that we can be able to track whether any progress is made with regards to the implementation of the APP. But sometimes we'll find a situation whereby the departments will indicate that they have to submit the stress plan. Then 2 months down the line, they have to submit the APP. Can I be clarified on that one?
You are during the process of, I just want to raise my own question. In this process of auditing, the findings are not
only known towards the end of the process. There is a step-by-step, maybe quarterly assessment, so that the department, each and every step of the way, they'll be able to know whether they will reach the intended objective of a clean audit or not. Now, I want to find out, because surely this audit is done over time, year in, year out, and so on. And I'm sure the office of the AG would know, will even to some extent, I think, presume that obviously Department A, B, and Z obviously will always come toward the negative as opposed toward the positive. Now, I want to find out what are the consequences of a perpetual offender, if you like, a department which continuously tread within a territory which is painted red. What are the consequences? Whether you just report it and leave it at that and go again the next cycle, report it. Because I think the aim of the audit would be to correct the department. The more department comply, the better for the entire government, especially in terms of service delivery, making sure that there's value for money for delivery of services. That would be my position or comment. Over to you.
Thank you, Chair. Allow me to start with the last question and link it to the first question, not on behalf of the department though, just from the lessons learned from the AG side. On a yearly basis, after we have presented the outcomes to the department, because you are correct in saying that the audit findings are communicated with the department throughout the audit. So when we identify findings, we raise what we call communication of audit findings. And at the end of the audit, which is twice a year, which is during the interim, which we normally finalize during towards the end of February, and the final audit, which we normally finalize towards the end of June, beginning of July, we will then present a draft management report to the department with all the findings that we have communicated throughout the audit. Ideally, what the department will do is, in their response to these audit findings, when they do acknowledge the validity of the findings, they will then indicate the steps that they will take to correct the findings and commit to a date. However, at the end of the audit, once we have delivered the audit report to the department at the end of July, they will then compile a consolidated action plan to address each of these findings that we have raised and also commit to a date. And this action plan will then be evaluated and by internal audit as well on a regular basis and reported to the audit committee in terms of progress that has been made. Bearing in mind that, as I have indicated, some of these initiatives do not really bear fruit, so they will not really be effective, hence we see repeat findings year on year. and the question linked to that is, what then are the consequences? And generally, what we have also found across the public sector is that there are lack of consequences in relation to the individual. But again, we say the major root cause is that there are no performance contracts entered into with individuals. That's one. Two, where performance contracts are signed and agreed on, which is normally with senior management, the performance evaluation doesn't really happen or is not really effective. And we're saying this because there are a number of instances where there is perpetual non-compliance and you know, nothing really happens out of it. In some instances, there will be training to address the gaps that exist between the individual and the policies and procedures that are in place. But the hard consequences in the public sector is really, really lacking in this instance. And hence we talk about accountability, because all of these people that exist in an organization, they are there to support the accounting officer, who is in turn answerable to the minister and should give the minister proper information and confirmation that all the checks and balances have been put in place and there is that discipline within the entity. One of the other challenges that we have had is that and if you look at the outcomes of the rural development portfolio, when it comes to income and expenditure, there are no serious findings in relation to that, because there you find that there are proper disciplines in terms of reporting on a monthly basis. But when you look at the disclosure notes, for argument's sake, and the disclosure notes would be things like the commitments. If you go to Ngonyama, it would be your land, for instance. It will be approval for argument's sake. That's where you will find that there's either material adjustments to the financial statements or the entities will receive a qualification. And this is because these items or these components are only dealt with at year end. There are no monthly disciplines to make sure that these components are accounted for on a monthly basis. And what we are saying when we talk about financial and performance management system is that if these disclosure notes were addressed and dealt with on a monthly basis, it reduces the burden at year end to then go and look for all these amounts that must go in there, check completeness, check credibility, and check all of these things, because there is a discipline to deal with them on a yearly basis, on a monthly basis, excuse me, and we have then learned the gaps that will or that might result in the information that we provide being incomplete or inaccurate or not credible. And we don't repeat those mistakes at the end. Chair, you asked about the consequences relating to the entity as a whole, and I know that I dealt with the consequences relating to the individuals. In my view, if there are proper consequences communicated and put into practice at an individual level, it will make sure that these disciplines are instilled widely in an organization. With regard to the technical indicators, the technical indicator specifically relates to how the APP must be done. For instance, if you have a specific target, the technical indicator will require you to indicate what type of evidence will be used to support the outcome that you are looking for. So it forces the departments and entities to identify a specific outcome and what evidence are they going to collate to make sure that that specific target is met. With regard to the taping of the stress and the APP, as you can see, we have no areas of non-compliance with regard to the department. I think when the stress and the APP must be tabled is legislated. However, the reason why we look at the APPs and in terms of legislation, if there are any changes the department or the entity would like to make on the APP, the requirement is that it must go through the same approval route that the initial one has gone through. But the technical indicator set by a national treasury is purely to give guidance and to remove ambiguity relating to the target or the outcome and the evidence that should be used, because that's normally the challenge that we face when we get the supporting evidence and we look at the target that they have reported. They don't talk to each other, and then we engage into this debate with the department in terms of what is the real evidence. So if they have identified it documentary right from the beginning, then there's no ambiguity, and I believe that it causes them to over-apply their mind in terms of does this talk to what we want to really achieve. I don't know if Eugene wants to add anything on the technical indicators, and we can please respond on the Ingonyama Trust.
Thank you, Macy. So nothing to add on the indicators. I'd just like to respond on the Ingonyama Trust question. The reason why it's yellow is because there were no movements from the prior year to the current year, and it remains zero. So even though they didn't incur any fruitless or irregular expenditure for the 2 years, so we're just showing the yellow as no movement, so it's not an improvement or a regression.
Maybe it should have been a green.
Maybe it should have made it green, yes. I'll look into that. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. Madam Messingau and your team for the presentation. It does offer us a kind of a preparation for tomorrow's engagement with the department. We really appreciate that. And on behalf of this committee, I really want to thank you sincerely for the effort you have taken to come and be with us, to share with us the information that you did, Eugene. Thank you very much. Having no further questions and comments, I can only say have a safe trip to Fani. Safe trip to Pretoria. I know Tswane might create problems for me, but I prefer to call it Tswane nevertheless. So thank you very much for the presentation, and committee members, thank you very much. You know that we still have an engagement after this one. Yes, so you can just stick around for a while and give our visitors an opportunity to move on. Thank you very much. Makoto, also thank you very much once again. Thank you. The meeting is adjourned.
Thank you.
Close the window.